pianist Daniel Barenboim and conductor Otto Klemperer demonstrating the gentle repose and classic poise of one of the world's great piano concertos. One of the choices of my guest today, who began her career as a model, graduated as an actress by way of an immensely popular TV series called The New Avengers, has since embraced stage roles from Chekhov to Black Farce, and who last year produced her elegant autobiography, Stare Back and Smile. She's staring at me right now, which must make me the envy of at least 5 million men, and her name is Joanna Lumley. Miss Lumley.
Robin.
It's only a guess, but I think that anyone who has a love for classical music is almost certain to have got to know Beethoven's Emperor Concerto before the age of 20. So was this a tingle from your youth too?
Yes, it was, before the age of 10 with me.
Mm-hmm.
My parents both love classical music, and the earliest Beethovens I could remember were obviously the Pastoral and the Seventh and the Eroica. And this was one of the very earliest piano memories I have. And the man never ceases to amaze me. He has to, rather like Elvis Presley in the sort of rock side, he has to be on the top of my list of favourite people. When I drop down dead, I hope Beethoven will be waiting at the other side to take me through.
Has music always been a part of your life, or are you aware of a point where you suddenly realised how important it was to you?
I think it had always been playing in the background. We lived in the Far East, and so most of the music was played on 78s on a wind-up gramophone.
Mm.
And so you got to know your favourite bits on which side of the record it was, and carrying them carefully around and putting them back in their huge brown sleeves. But it goes back as far as I can remember, which would take me to about 2 years old in Hong Kong, when I can remember early Mozart and Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always been there.
Actually, your next choice isn't musical, in the strict sense, that is. It's the sound of a cuckoo. Now, is this just the sound or the association?
Oh, the association. Well, I'd been abroad for so long. When I came back, finally, we'd had short home leave in England. But when England first smote me, I was 8. We'd been travelling for a month on a ship coming back from Singapore. And we arrived in England in June and went to stay with my aunt on a farm. And that June evening, it must have been about June the 2nd, I can remember going out in the garden and smelling English roses. In Malaya, we had some roses, but they didn't smell. Smelling roses and hearing the cuckoo, which absolutely astonished me. It was such an incredible sound.
Very English. But as you say, most of your life was spent abroad. What did your daddy do that meant you had to be born?
He was with the army, with the Indian army, with the Gurkhas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was born in India, and then we went out to Hong Kong, and then we were in Malaya for 3 years during the emergency. So it was all Far Eastern stuff, and all to do with just different sights and sounds and different kind of religions. And of course, it was absolutely home for me. And so England, which of course is now my home, seemed to me a foreign land.
I notice there's no English music on your list. Does that mean that you have some general reservations about things English?
Not. But I love the whole feeling of English church music, which, now that I'm married to Stephen Barlow, he's introduced me to all sorts of people like Tallis. But the earliest idea of choral singing, I was only 9 when I first heard the Vienna Boys Choir, and I fell in love with the sound of boys singing. And, I mean, how extraordinary to come across that. But I'd never sung in a choir or even heard choirs singing from my Far Eastern upbringing. And the first time I heard this particular piece, Allegri's Miserere, I couldn't believe the sound of the boy's voice, and I rushed to study the recording. I think it's one of the most extraordinary pieces of music.
Thank you.
hearing Roy Goodman talking about recording that, and in those days it wasn't specified which boy would be singing the solo, and they'd just come running in all muddy from playing games and rushed with muddy boots on underneath their surplices into the chapel. And David Wilcox just pointed at him and said, "You're singing the solo today." And I think that shows in this recording. There's no sense of preciousness or personality. It's simply serving the music, the best way of doing anything, I think.
I wonder if we could try for a moment to pin down what actually happens inside you when you hear musical moments which give you a thrill, or what is it? Or does it vary with different music?
I think it varies with different music, because some music really does seem to be storytelling, in that images seem to appear in your head. But it's very odd, because although I love languages, I don't really know the musical language, in that I'm not a singer or a musician myself. But I do feel this old phony thing of that it is a language which most people can and do understand in some way. And when it is your music, when you hear a piece and it seems to be yours, it's as if, in a funny way, as if you almost invented it, as if you're uncovering that piece of your own music within you, which links like a piece in a jigsaw puzzle into that bit of music. And that's where I think it makes it, those bits that you wait for and you go, "That's my bit, that's my bit." It's extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Well, now your next choice is an extract from an opera by Puccini, so there's no problem about visual images, because presumably you see the scene that you saw when you saw the opera, or
yes,
did you just come to it from a gramophone record?
No, I came to it in an opera. It's Turandot, and I saw it at the Royal Opera House last year, and it absolutely astonished me, the whole thing. And this particular piece was spine-chilling, because, of course, it's a very bloody and tragic story. But this bit, which comes when the people of China have just been calling in a bloodthirsty way, they're longing for a death, they're longing for this execution to come, and they've been sharpening up their knives and waiting. But the executions can only take place when the moon has risen. And they're calling, they can't understand, they're going, "Why hasn't the moon risen just yet? Send the moon." And all these ghastly, murderous people suddenly sing with this unbelievable sweetness. I think the pain of it was just I was on the edge of my seat, and I just glanced around, and the whole opera house was still rigid like a photograph.
Herbert von Karajan with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra in part of Puccini's Turandot. It's not just that he's a great composer, is it? It's the fact that he's such a supreme dramatist.
That's right.
That seems to make it work.
Absolutely phenomenal. And I think he must be, although it sounds a strange thing to say, I would have thought that if you were first going to an opera, Puccini would be a wonderful place to begin. because this, as you say, the sense of theatre is absolutely overwhelming. And if you can see a good production, I think you've gone to heaven.
Now, hard on the heels of Puccini telling us of the moon, we have another picture of it, this time by the composer Karl Orff, he of the well-known Carmina Burana.
This is rather extraordinary. Well, it's such an odd, unknown little opera. Having said that, a million people will write and say, but we've all known this for years. It's called Der Mond, The Moon, and it's almost a children's opera. The story being that the moon is stolen from the sky by some ne'er-do-wells, and eventually St. Peter takes it back and hangs it up there. But it's an absolutely extraordinary piece of music the whole way through. Really beautiful, and I long to see it. I know it's going to be very expensive to put on, but it's one of those things that one would love to do, perhaps as an opera at Christmas time for children and grown-ups, of course. And at the end of it, it's got this quite extraordinary coup de théâtre. A little child says, finally the moon hangs back, and the little child comes out of its house. Moon's been missing for nights. And he says, ah, the moon's hanging there. And people slowly come out of their houses and see it up there.
Ah, da hängt ja der Mond.
And then when all the people have come running out from the house and they've all seen and it's all good and there's a great gentleness and a feeling, a little zither plays and all's right with the world, and the dead suddenly moan in their graves with satisfaction that the moon has come back. And it's an absolutely extraordinary sound.
Herbert Kegel conducting the Leipzig Radio Orchestra in Part of the Moon by Karl Orff.
Now, as you say, your husband is a professional musician. I was wondering, he obviously influences you quite a lot, as you've said, but do you influence him? Do you pull him to music which he might not normally appreciate, or is it all one-way traffic?
Well, funnily enough, I said to him, do you know Berlioz's Requiem? And he said, I don't think I do, which is why I rushed off. I've shown it to you. I bought it for him because I wanted him to hear it. I thought he must know it. Of course he knows it. But perhaps he hasn't. Perhaps it just, I mean, he knows so much. Anyway, it's rather exciting. I can take it back home and say, this is the bit I heard the other day. Isn't it marvellous?
So it's not hard to live with someone who is obviously musically extremely erudite. You don't feel put down by it at all.
No, because he doesn't make me feel like that. I'm sure some would. And he absorbs all my naive, sort of childlike things and is... It's just wonderful, you know, not to have your knuckles wrapped for saying the odd dumb thing.
Jana Lumley, looking back on the choice so far on your list, I remarked earlier it contains a lot of popular composers, but very few great classical hits and no popular music, no Sinatra, no Streisand, no Beatles. Now, I would have put you down very much as a child of the 1960s. Does pop music appeal to you?
Or? Hugely, yes. But they are usually what I'm slightly jaded at. They are sort of raves from the grave. And a lot of them are connected with the fact that it reminds me of that wonderfully happy time, you know. I can see that musically they're not immensely sound. Yeah. But having said that, of course, the Beatles and people like this were marvellous, and I listened to a lot of them. But when it comes to, you know, when it comes, when you push comes to shove and you put the pieces out and the thing, regrettably, some of them slide away and old Mozart comes in instead of the Beatles. In an ideal world, and in my longer choice, in my next programme with you, Robin, which will be the 24 choices, they will be in there, as will Sinatra, and dear favourites like Matt Munro and... I don't know, Al Boley and all sorts of wonderful people, you know. But at the moment, it does seem to be classical.
Mm-hmm. Like Mozart, I mean, very emotional underneath, but expressed with great classical restraint.
Just wonderful. Again, the first time I heard this, The Marriage of Figaro, and when the Countess sang, you know, what's happened to all those happy days and those wonderful times, and why is it when all the tears and the misery have still gone, why do I still remember the happy memories? And I think that's rather... She still loves the Count. She can still forgive him for anything, but there's that ghastly moment of a woman getting older, perhaps, looking back and thinking, when did it all go wrong?
Pop in part of an aria from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. Do you think music can be a force for good? Do you think it can actually be physically therapeutic?
I'm certain of it. I'm a patron of something called the Speedwell Trust, which is helping people who are either emotionally or you know, mentally disturbed, and it is really working with music. Quite often the only way through to autistic people or very, very seriously disturbed people is through music and rhythm to start with, and then music. And the freedom, the opening up, again, it's this language. And sometimes people who get stuck in a rut are simply freed and healed by music. I'm perfectly certain it's one of the greatest, along with the touch of animals and all these other things which sound a bit primitive and a little bit kind of like green zeeb man, you know. But the truth is, Robin, it all makes sense, you know. If only we could bring a bit more of it into our lives. I don't mean necessarily playing it on loudspeakers like they did in Russia, you know, martial bands, you know, to make us feel invigorated. But I think that we really ought to give way to more tranquil music.
Mm. So Richard Strauss next, and another German composer. Keen on German. Well
I know, but you put this to me. I didn't really think of it like that. I didn't really go through the nationality book when I was picking them. This was... just because I hadn't heard them before I met Stephen. The four last songs. And they were, I think, the last things he composed before he died. And he was a very old man and a very wise old man. A wonderful musician. And I think the last opera he did was Capriccio, which was debating about words and music, which comes first and which is the most important. And he leaves that one hanging in the air. And then these four last songs, but the third verse of Going to Sleep by M. Schlafengehen, which says, the spirit unguarded longs to soar on free wings so that in the magic circle of night it may live deeply and a thousandfold. Well, what a way to go to bed.
Elisabeth Schwarzkopf singing the third of Strauss's four last songs with the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by George Sell. Joanna Lumley, it would be misleading to give the impression that your career has been nothing but a...
doddle.
Yes, an endless succession of upward leaps. You recently had a flop, a stage play called Vanilla. Mm. I must say, when I read the notices, which were so terrible... And they quoted some of the lines in the play. I quite wanted to go and see it. I thought it sounded very funny. Were you shocked to find that the critics simply didn't think it was good like you thought it was good?
Yes, because I think all actors think that, because we all got the script and we all roared with laughter and we all seized on it, a very distinguished cast, and the director, Harold Pinter, and we all thought it was wildly funny. As I must add, did most of the audiences who came to see it, who then wrote us copious letters saying, why is it coming off? We were going to, you know, start booking heavily. So it is a matter of opinion, and I think that the critics are perfectly entitled to their opinion. I must add that they were all slavishly kind to the performers and all homed in on the play and said it was rubbish, which I thought was tough, really tough, because it wasn't rubbish. It was hard-hitting and rather black and perhaps not what they expected. I think they couldn't get over the fact that Pinter directed it. I think they'd followed the idea of Pinter and, you know, No Man's Land or but The Birthday Party, and they couldn't forgive him for doing something so frivolous. Mm. And so they got awfully miffed. Mm. And it came out in their crits. Not all of them, some of them said, rush and see it, it's absolute magic, as bad taste as you can get.
And you said your notices weren't personally bad, but I mean, does it hurt when that happens?
Of course it does.
Are you not immune from it yet?
No, of course it hurts, because it's thrilling to be in a soaring sensation and terribly sad to be on a play which is suddenly receiving no publicity and people are booking for the next show. That's the other thing, you know, people waiting at the box office and saying, sorry, we're going to see Burn This and not
the other
show.
Queue.
The other queue, you know.
Terrible.
And of course one has tremendous loyalty towards the play and the people you're with. But when it goes, actors have to learn this. You put on a bright smile and wave goodbye. I keep saying bright smile, but it's sort of true. So much of it is getting on with it, you know, not giving way to senses of despondency or personal failure. You mustn't let that creep in.
Mm. We're going out on a blaze of Wagner.
Well, I mean, honestly, this man, I think it's just tremendous stuff. I can't think what sort of parade I'd like to be in, but, you know, I think some of this sort of music should be playing us out. You can't help holding your head up high and walking along. I'm sure that all this sort of military and martial and rousing music is adopted by all sorts of bad people. But you must wipe that away, because music is its own. It doesn't belong to politics, and it doesn't belong to other people who've enjoyed it. It simply belongs to its own time and its own sense of being. And this prelude to Act Three of Lohengrin, it almost makes you think, well, I needn't even stay for Act Three, actually. This is pretty good stuff.